The Retirement Conversation focuses on the changing nature of retirement today and the non-financial aspects of a successful retirement transition. Join Joe and Dennis and learn from leading experts in the field and the stories of people who have created interesting second acts. You'll take away practical ideas and tips to create your own. At Retirement Wisdom, we as retirement coaches help people think through their transition into retirement, as well as those who are in the early part of retirement but are looking for more from this stage of their lives. To find out more about us and how we can help you, you can schedule a free, no-obligation consultation with us. Simply go to retirementwisdom.com. On the top left corner, click on Get a Free Consultation. We would welcome the opportunity to speak to you. Join our conversations and get wiser about your retirement.
Welcome to today's Retirement Conversation with our guest, Michelle Panosilva. Michelle is an assistant professor at the University of Toronto with joint appointments in the Department of Sociology and Public Health. Dr. Silva's primary areas of research include work, aging, and retirement, health information seeking, and perceptions about aging and health. Her book, Retirement and Its Discontents, was published in 2018 by Columbia University Press. She received a BA, BS, and MPP from the University of California, Berkeley, and a PhD from the University of Chicago. Michelle, thanks so much for joining us today. Is there anything else you'd like to add to your bio?
Sure. Thanks, Joe and Dennis. I'm so glad to be on your show. I guess you could add that I'm originally from Los Angeles, and I've progressively lived in colder climates my entire life. I don't know if that's such a fun fact, but it's a fact about my life.
You've certainly learned to layer as you move north.
Yeah. Sometimes I learned the hard way. But I have learned that lesson.
So, Michelle, what led you to research retirement and to write this book?
So, I grew up with a dad that was significantly older than most of my peers' parents. My dad was in his mid-50s when I was born. And so issues about aging, all sort of aspects of them have always been on my radar from a pretty early age. And when I was in my early 20s, my dad developed dementia, and his work had always been really important to him. He had been a social worker, and he was really devoted to his work and his clients. And when he developed dementia, my siblings really took on the onus of the personal aspects of managing his care, and I was tasked with closing his office. And when I did that, I literally shredded the files and closed it up and locked the door. And I think the process of doing that, of sort of closing off that aspect of his identity, really made me think about the end of one's career, and what that means. And it made me think about it, I think, in ways that, made a deeper impression on me, because he wasn't able to really understand what was happening. He wasn't able to internalize that process or really even have the wherewithal to know that that's what I was doing. So I realized it was a really big deal. And so I started to think about, what did I just do? And what does retirement mean, especially for someone whose work is a really important part of their life. Of course, I was really early in my, this is a while ago, and I was really early in my studies and in my, my career trajectory. And I noticed there's a lot of emphasis put on early career transitions, but really not so much attention, especially, this was a couple decades ago, not so much emphasis on how to deal with later career transitions. So, eventually as you mentioned, I went on to graduate school, and when I was there, I studied retirement trajectories. I took a quite a quantitative approach. I did some econometric modeling of looking at the type of work people did and health outcomes using a big public data set. And at a certain point, I kind of came back to questions about what does retirement mean? Here I was coding people into the category of being retired based on their hours worked and their income or their lack of income and that sort of thing. And, economists make these assumptions about you know, what work hours and income means in order to define a person. And of course, I did make those assumptions, as well as a whole bunch of other econometric assumptions that we make. But I started to have questions that, you know, reemerged about, you know, not just like how can we code people as retirement in such black and white terms, but also, you know, what is the experience really like, and how do people define retirement for themselves, and, you know, why was it that the transition was turning out better for some people than others? And so eventually I got some qualitative training, and I started out on a set of studies that led to my book.
And it's interesting. Many people think of retirement as nirvana. The idea of not working can sound great, especially on some days. But your book shows that after a honeymoon period, it's not exactly nirvana for everyone. And what did you find not working creates in terms of challenges if someone's identity is closely tied to their work?
Yeah, for many people, retirement is nirvana. Many, many people, retirement is freedom, right? It's like a prisoner getting out of jail and a wonderful break, you know, a time to enjoy the fruits of their labors. And I actually think that for most people, you know, assuming that you've, you know, done the financial planning and that your health and the health of those around you is good, I really do believe that that it can be a wonderful experience. To get to your question, and the focus of my book is looking at, you know, but what about those people for whom their personal identity is really close to their professional work? How about for that subset? And you know, of course, that's not everybody. I'm really, really careful. I've got a big methodological appendix in the book to explain that, you know, it's this sentiment that I'm describing is really not one that's intended to be generalized. It's really one that is just meant to shed light on a subgroup that I don't think has really gotten a lot of light shed on. And so, you know, for this subgroup, retirement really can create challenges. Again, to answer your question, like, it can create this sort of sense of feeling ungrounded, feeling insignificant, feeling marginalized. You know, again, like, for people who derive their sense of self-worth from their work, retirement can be a blow to who they are. And I think that's something that that really does get glossed over, and that, you know, is an important point worth sharing. That, you know, for those who fall into this category, they're not alone. I think there's a lot of pressure to sort of ignore those sentiments. And you know, I think almost everyone can relate to the idea of having a break, or, you know, not working for a certain period of time. That is really, you know, a wonderful thing to just get a breather. But I'm not sure that the idea of never, ever working again is for everyone. And that's sort of the way that traditional retirement is defined. It's, you know, not working. So, you know, for the people that I interviewed, some of them did have a honeymoon period. Not all of them did, though. Some of them immediately felt ungrounded. There was one participant who I interviewed, and he told me that, you know, that feeling of discontent that for him emerged, like, literally within a day of retiring. And so, you know, I'll share with you a bit about the different stories, but you know, they came about in various ways. One of the physicians I interviewed retired at 65, and he stayed retired, you know, unlike some of the other participants who jumped back into the workforce, you know, like, as quick as they possibly could. But this physician who, you know, he stayed retired and never felt that same sense of connection to society. And so, you know, to answer your question, people describe for me real feelings of being disconnected and disengaged from society when they retired.
So you're feedback, your experience and some of the research points to social aspects, feeling disconnected from the social side, and more from the standpoint of feeling, when you say disconnected, are they just not sure what to do with themselves? What other feedback did you get in that regard?
Yeah, so, you know, for the most part, the people that I interviewed, they had derived a important part of their self-esteem from their work. Their work was meaningful to society, or the work was meaningful, like, for their own, you know, personal circle. And when they retired, they really felt discarded. They really felt like, you know, like they were no longer needed. And one of the CEOs that I interviewed, he described for me, he had had some experience with extramarital affairs, and he explained to me, you know, he had this sort of sense of like just wanting to hear that he was still desirable, that he was still, you know, so he said something like, you know, I felt like it was, you know, being, it was like I was waiting for the mistress to call me and just let me know that I was still in demand. And yet, you know, the phone never rang. And just wanting to have that sort of sense of like, yeah, I'm still important. I still matter. That was something that several participants explained that they really missed that.
Academic research can indeed lead down different roads. So you've got some interesting stories, but you interviewed an interesting mix of people from five occupations: CEOs, doctors, elite athletes, professors, and homemakers. The timing of their retirements was influenced, and in some of the cases, I think, driven by different factors. What are some of the challenges that timing of retirement can create?
Yeah, so timing really does matter. And it matters in different ways. And so, I'd love to share with you some different examples. But one of the overall points of my book is to say that in some ways, there is so much emphasis put on timing in the sense of chronological age. And I argue, you know, when it comes to retirement, right? Like, it depends on, you know, what country's pension system you're following, but when you hit that magic, whether it's Freedom 55 or the magic 65 or 67, or now it's like 68 and a half, depending on when you're born, that sort of thing, that number seems to be so important, because it's tied to financial incentives. But I really argue that chronological age is really not predictive of much once we get into adulthood, beyond telling you when your next birthday is going to occur. We are very diverse in adulthood. And so to link it with productivity or the idea that someone, you know, is going to be more likely to be creative and come up with ideas based on their age in adulthood, I really strongly disagree with. And so I just want to make sure that I get that point in, that that yes, you know, I'll give you some examples of how timing matters, but I also really want to make the point that timing, or maybe age, is more to the point that I want to make, that age is as important as you make it. And right, you know, at this point, society, I believe, is quite ageist, is really forming lots of unfortunate connections between age and productivity, for example, in the workforce. And because of that, we are missing out on really great, valuable contributions that people have yet to make. But let me answer a question. So, you know, to get to the point about timing, it matters largely because, you know, when you're forced into it, and then this is a point I think, you know, many of your guests and people have made, obviously in the academic literature, being forced into retirement is a factor that has been very clearly studied, that it's not good. We as humans don't really like being forced into anything. And that, of course, creates challenges. I want to share a couple of examples. You mentioned I interviewed elite athletes, and, you know, and that's a kind of convenient place to start because they retire so young. And I purposely included them in my book because I'd done a study of people who had represented their country at Olympic Games, and And you know, at first for me, it was like, wait a minute, is this really about retirement? When I first started into the study, it's a whole big long story about how I got connected with this group. But I thought it was really important to include because they retire so young, and it really plays and pulls with the idea that retirement isn't about age or really shouldn't be. So one of the participants I interviewed, her name was Allison, and she was a rhythmic gymnast. She retired at 21, and when she did, the world as she knew it fell apart. She really struggled with reestablishing her sense of purpose and engaging with the world as she knew it because she had started training at 4 years old. She had moved away from her family to be with coaches and had, you know, literally traveled the world, had worked for 8 hours a day if she got her routine right, 6 days a week for, you know, for like 15 years. And it was, you know, really a true challenge when she retired, both physically and emotionally. She said, can I read you a little quote from her?
Sure.
I don't have many, but I thought I might share hers. So, you know, she said to me, to represent your country in Olympic Games is the ultimate goal. The fact that I got to the highest level in my sport, there's nothing higher than that in gymnastics. She said, I think I've always been very appreciative of my training and her life, and my life's been really unique. And she thought she had prepared herself for retirement. But she said that, you know, she didn't get the kind of closure that she thought, and again, to go back to the quote, she says, like maybe that closure wouldn't have been there. Anyway, I made it to the very top, so I wasn't compelled to go back in and compete. But retirement was really disorienting and scary. And so, you know, she explained to me that even though it wasn't about, you know, the impending end of her life course, it was about closing a chapter that, you know, had been her full source of identity. And, you know, a lot of times in gerontology, we look at older adults to sort of draw and learn for younger people. And here the point was also to look at stories of people who were experiencing things that were quite akin to what participants later in the life course described. Mm-hmm. Another example where timing mattered was with a CEO that I interviewed in the book. I use pseudonyms in the book, but so the pseudonym I gave him was Steve, and he was forced to retire in his 50s. He had steadily risen to the top of his career ladder, becoming a CEO of a very large university health network, and you know, he'd always like been focused in his life on work and achievement, and he had a retirement plan in place. But in his case, his retirement was really a euphemism to publicly describe what was a termination. There'd been some money mismanagement, and it was a real struggle because he had to deal with this quote retirement that was something that was forced upon him, something that he had looked forward to, but because the way the timing occurred and the sort of way that he had been pushed into it, that was a real struggle. And you know, there are other participants that I interviewed who, you know, retired right when they planned to. Another is Wendy, who is a family doctor, retired right at 65. She retired of her own planning and choosing. But when she did, she just felt the world sort of crash around her, literally, like the day after she failed to renew her license, her medical license. And you know, she had really, throughout her life, struggled with the complexities of being a woman in medicine, balancing work and family. She had 4 kids. She also had some issues between her husband, who was also a physician. And anyway, it just sort of all came crashing down when she had to reestablish her sense of self, but without the title of doctor in front of her name anymore. And so, you know, it brought out all these sorts of issues with regard to no longer having the maybe even distraction of work to keep her busy and structured. So there's lots of different stories that are shared. Some of the academics have very, very different types of stories because they stayed on for a really long time and retired much, much later in the life course. and some found their way back into the university or just found other ways of contributing. But in any event, you know, the point is that it wasn't just about being forced. You know, there's lots of different stories. Some were forced, some retired of their own choosing. But what they had in common was this sense that that they didn't have a part of their adulthood, part of their life that they had devoted so much of themselves to. And suddenly their adulthood was sort of was restructured without any sort of structure to it.
Michelle, what was unique about the homemaker group? And I'm curious, what can we learn from them, even if we're not personally in that category?
Yes, and I just gave you a bunch of examples without even one from the homemaker group. So yeah, homemakers are definitely a really unique group. They're an often overlooked subset of society who are rarely given credit for their work, and yet a homemaker's work is never done, right? Mm-hmm. And the idea of a retired homemaker, it'll irritate some people, particularly those who conscribe to this idea that retirement begins at the end of a career of paid work. Many economists that I know will really take issue with the idea of labeling someone in that way. There's almost no large data set that will allow you to code someone as both retired and a homemaker. And it's true, homemakers don't get paid for their work in most countries around the world. They won't receive a pension or any sort of retirement compensation for their work. And yet, you know, there's quite a bit to learn from them. One is that the amount of money that you earn for your work does not translate into how much you care about it or how much a person identifies with that work that they do. So, you know, while it might seem kind of like the groups of people that are in my book are sort of, you know, quite varied, they all shared in common a sense that the work they did was their life's work and that it was the way they identified themselves for the bulk of their adulthood. So, you know, it seems kind of like, oh, of course a doctor is going to identify strongly with their work. Or CEO, you know, but there were very different ways in which their work lives played out. But the ways that they experienced the transition from being important for their work to no longer being able to have that as the core of their identity was actually remarkably similar. The other sort of takeaway from the homemakers, you know, that I think holds, you know, even if you're not, most people are actually not homemakers, right? It's a sort of unique and perhaps a subset that, you know, may be going extinct, you know, at least as we know it. But another sort of takeaway from the homemakers is that they highlighted for me is that retirement is a really complicated term. So, you know, I connected with the women that I interviewed for this chapter in my book based on a larger study that I did, which is published in an academic journal. And I won't get into the details of, you know, the inclusion criteria and that sort of thing. But I do think it's important to say that this was a subset of women who identified as retired homemakers. And of course, not all homemakers will identify this way. But what we can learn is this idea that retirement is an ever-evolving, dynamic, and complex social construct. You know, it's very easy to just associate it with the end of one's career, but for some people, like, for example, this very unique subset of women, retirement was operationalized as this ambiguous term. And for some of them, it was a preferable term. Some of the women that I interviewed describe, you know, whose stories are shared in the book, described how they preferred it to that of being a divorcee or being a widow or other sorts of identifiers that gave a lot of information about themselves. It was a sort of uninhibited a title that allowed them to be, you know, kind of socially ambiguous. And it was really, really fascinating to kind of get to know them and their stories because, you know, They simultaneously used and ignored social cues when they adopted the term of retiree, and they came to it in very different ways. Some of it was because the mail that they kept getting titled them as a retiree, or, you know, they went to the movie theater or the community center and they saw, you know, retiree, or, and it opened up a bunch of, you know, social connections and discounts and things that were actually beneficial that that they, you know, benefited from and quite enjoyed. It was a way of connecting with people that wasn't open to them because of their other titles or other things that they had going on at that point in their lives. So, you know, it sort of gave them opportunity to embrace this new title and in some ways a socially preferable status. And so, you know, it was only open to them at this later point in their life. So I think there's something to be learned from this sort of unusual use of retirement because it highlights the ambiguity and dynamism and, you know, opportunities that can be associated with retirement.
Great points. Thanks.
Social cues matter. I was in an airport 2 years ago at age 59. Went to buy a cup of tea, and they gave me the the senior citizen discount, which I was highly offended by, and renegotiated my price of my cup of tea.
Sure.
So the narratives in your book highlight the tensions that emerge during the transition to retirement between what's gained and what's lost. You mentioned structure before. There seems to be some tension between freedom and structure. How did the people you interviewed struggle with those tensions, and how did some work to reconcile them?
Yeah, that's a great question. And you know, the name of my book, Retirement and Its Discontents, really draws from Freud's Civilization and Its Discontents. There, you know, Freud articulated the contrast between an individual's quest for freedom and social norms that restrict our primitive instincts. So, you know, Freud argued that social norms and rules and laws that state, for example, that we shouldn't commit adultery or that we shouldn't inflict harm on other people, those limit our possibilities for satisfaction and for contentment. And yet, as a society, we agree to live within those boundaries and to follow those rules. And in my book, I explain that a fundamental tension exists between the autonomy and flexibility and the lack of boundaries that are associated with retirement and our instincts to maintain structure and a sense of social connectedness and personal fulfillment. And so, you know, I explain and I argue that retirement has been socially constructed in a way that can give rise to feelings of great discontentment as it sort of stymies some paths in favor of others. And so the people that I interviewed, they struggled with that tension. And some reconciled that by throwing themselves into new ways of recalibrating their identity. The family physician that I mentioned, who really struggled when it came time, when she decided to not renew her medical license, she, you know, started by taking a pottery class, eventually started with some art history classes in a continuing education program. Eventually, she really recalibrated herself and literally just like came to the realization that she was a learner. Like she was motivated by continually learning new things, right? And she had always channeled it into medicine and into, you know, just like figuring out what her patients needed and as I described, like literally everything she did was for her patients. She told me when she exercised because she thought she needed to be fit for her patients. Like she didn't do it for herself or for her, you know, husband or her, she had a boyfriend. You know, she didn't do it for any of that. She did it because, you know, everything she did was for her work and she, you know, was constantly keeping up to date with the new necessary medical information. And so anyway, when she retired, she realized that was actually something that she enjoyed kind of regardless of the substance. It was, she just needed to have that sense of like learning and building on information. And so so for her, you know, it kind of took form in like what some might argue is you know, allied with medicine, but it was, some might argue is like the total opposite side of our brain. And so she like dove deep into art history, and that sort of just like took on a life of its own. And she was like, yeah, she could be like a professor of it at a certain point. You know, last time I interviewed her, she has like so many classes under her belt. And there are others who, you know, they do it with decorating or with volunteer work, gardening. I mean, there's, you know, it's silly almost to like list off the types of things. There's lots of wonderful books that will give you many, many ideas about how to or what to do, you know, what to do in retirement, right? The point is to say that just like looking at what are the kinds of things that motivate you, that helped you excel in your work, and just do a 180 and rechannel those into yourself, your family, your, you know, proximal world, maybe your neighborhood. That was something that really, I think, helped people reconcile their sense of discontentment, was applying the things that made them good at their work or that made them feel good in their work to their proximal world, to the you know, whether it was their grandchildren or their neighbors or their partner or their themselves or traveling very far away. That was something that really helped. And for other people, it was going back into the workforce.
Sure.
And like I said, some people did it within 24 hours. Yeah. And that's okay. There's nothing wrong with that. Like I said, we are missing out on a big subset of people who you know, think that For some reason, there's a magic associated with your chronological age that's going to dictate, you know, whether or not you have contributions to make.
That's such a good point about how society is ageist today. Do you see that starting to change, and what can help accelerate that shift? Because as you point out, companies, society, organizations missing out on such a great source of human capital.
Yeah, I think, yeah, like I really want to validate that point. I think it is true. I mean, like, you know, your example with the cup of tea, I think that's a brilliant example, because I think it sort of symbolizes there's this idea that like we're being helpful by associating, you know, by, you know, like offering a discount, offering a reprieve from work, and, you know, telling people like, okay, you know, let's give you this discount, or let's sort of like down, let's take you out of the workforce now. And you know, we'll give you a fraction of your income, and you don't have to work. And isn't that great? And I would say, you know, for some people, and of course, for many, many people who are, you know, having health issues or for various reasons need to and want to retire, absolutely, I don't want to undermine people in those situations, right? Like for some people, that senior discount is essential, right? Like they can't afford the cup of tea if it's not offered, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't, you know, we of course don't mean to say that there aren't cases where it's extraordinarily helpful and important, essential even. Mm-hmm. But the idea that we just sort of assume that people want that discount, or we assume that people, you know, want to sort of scale back or disengage, that's the mistake. That's the ageism that I think is really worth shedding light on. Mm-hmm. and saying, you know, hang on, there are some very valuable contributions to be made. We need to first of all, have conversations about it and ask people, let them decide if they want the discount or not, right? And give people opportunities the way that we do often early in the workforce, early in one's career trajectory, to give them opportunities to pivot and to retrain and to build on their skills. You know, not to assume, oh, you know, that the, like often I'll hear people say, well, you know, they can be a mentor, or that's, you know, sort of the only option. And I really think that's important, that employers stop and pause and recognize that there are, you know, opportunities for mentorship, that more experienced workers can offer, but not to stop there. Actually, not even to necessarily start there, just to have that be one of many possible options, because actually it's quite nice when people are peer mentors, and you know, it's not necessarily the case that that, you know, there's lots of intergenerational tension out there. And anyway, so I'm going on a tangent about mentoring, but my point is to say that there are lots of different things that an experienced worker brings to an organization. And that it's really important that we stop assuming that there's only a handful of things or that that person wants to leave, but instead that employers really stop and open up the conversation and recognize that oftentimes the employee has lots of ideas about the ways they could be contributing more effectively.
Yeah, so a more collaborative approach to having that discussion and opening that up can lead to some really good options for people, both for the employer and employer. I think you made some great points. Yeah.
A related topic is a term that you came up with, and aging in place is a phrase that we've all become familiar with. But you've coined a new term in the book that I love, working in place. How can working in place be helpful to some people?
So I love that you're like already familiar with, and that I'm quite sure your audience will be familiar with aging in place. Not everybody I talk to is even on board with that idea. So the World Health Organization has promoted this, and, you know, around the world, lots of people are, though I just said not everybody is, the idea of like having people stay in their homes and in the community as long as possible. And the idea of working in place is sort of applying that to the workplace. So I bring that up in the chapter about academics to say that, you know, that the ability to work in place can be just as important in maintaining happiness and stability and mental acuity as being able to age in place. And so, I argue that, you know, there's been a bit said about unretirement and post retirement employment, and there's lots of different ways of saying that idea that people want, that many people want to re-enter the workforce. But very little has been said about people who want to do the same type of work in their retirement as they did before they retired. And so, you know, I came upon this subset of people, and the example here were academics who, in one case, had been forced into retirement because of mandatory retirement, and found a way, because he so wanted to keep doing what he had been doing, of going back to and working in the same environment, doing the same type of work he had post-retirement, but he had to retire. And I also came upon another individual who didn't have mandatory retirement, but who was pushed into it, because in many places mandatory retirement has become illegal, but yet it still is. It's done in other ways. People are pushed out even though it's not, quote, mandatory retirement, unquote. The idea of working in place is the idea of saying that, you know, there are some people who, quote, retire for, you know, whether it's a euphemism, whether they're pushed into it or whether they do it and they just realize actually that wasn't a good fit. But they want to go back and do the same thing that they did before, or a subset of what they did before. And the point is to just give it some description and to validate it that retirement doesn't have to represent a departure, but that it can be a continuation of achieving one's life goals.
Well said. And in listening to you today, you've pointed out that retirement's complex. And in your book, you mentioned that it's a subjective developmental transition. It's both personal and it's a social phenomenon. While each retirement can be unique, what are two or three things people should keep top of mind so that they can be well prepared?
So I think that financial planning is really important. I think I would keep that at top of the mind. And there are lots of great books, as guests on your show have discussed and as guests on your show have written about, to read up on what's available. There's also lots of great blogs and ways of getting information, even from the library. You know, you don't have to always pay for it. The point is that that is something that should be top of mind, because the worst case scenario, and you know, and in my book I write about people who were, you know, who put off retirement or had to keep working because they hadn't planned financially. And some of them were very wealthy individuals who, you know, for example, one of the physicians I interviewed was quite wealthy, but, you know, he had two marriages and, you know, several sets of children and really big financial obligations that he got himself into. But then he came to a point where he was forced into retirement. There was some, and I won't get into it here, but the point is that even if you make a lot of money, doesn't mean you've saved a lot of money. And so, you know, regardless of what your socioeconomic background is, it's the financial planning is something to keep at the top of the list. And again, my book is not about that. So it's really about people's stories. But, you know, implicit in there is the idea that that should be at the top of mind, to be prepared there. Okay, another thing to keep in mind is what I call, you know, decluttering. I think that there's been, you know, there's a lot of really fun ways that decluttering has been highlighted, not just with hoarders and not just with regard to your house, but with regard to the self. I would say that taking stock of what you have and making both physical and mental space at this point in one's life is really important. So, you know, the best way I can think of saying this is to say, declutter your life, focus in on what is most important. And, you know, like get rid of the extra files and piles. And I'm not saying you have to like fold your clothes necessarily the Marie Kondo way, yes. but take note of that idea of, you know, keeping in your life or in your head, the ideas that bring joy. And there's been a lot in the gerontological literature about this idea that that as we age, there is a positivity effect that we, you know, Laura Carstensen has written beautifully and quite elaborately about this concept. And I love her work, and I love this idea of taking stock, and you know, and I love the idea of sort of taking it a step further, just to say that. That this is an optimal way of thinking, even if it doesn't come naturally. The idea that as we age, we embrace more positive ideas should give even the most depressed of us. And you know, and I do write about people who were discontent, who experienced really dark points in their life, but to recognize that there is a positivity effect available. And if we can just sort of take stock and get rid of the excess and focus in on what's positive in our life, I think that is going to be a good thing to keep in mind. The other two I'll just quickly share are the idea of practicing, of preparing for the transition, of, you know, like many of us don't take lunch breaks, work all through our adulthood, like literally eat at the computer. And I'm not saying you have to go for a walk every day at lunch, but I'm saying that, you know, if you're planning to retire at a certain point, then prepare for the transition. Start taking a break at lunch. Like, I know this sounds ridiculous because many people are like, yeah, of course, that's a no-brainer. But a lot of people don't do that. And, you know, now, like, you know, as I write about, like, we're working 24/7 because of technologies available to us. We're expected to be on call even if we're not a physician because of just the way the work world is today. And so preparing, practicing, if you think that retirement's going to be this great time to take on lots of hobbies, then start practicing those hobbies now. I can't tell you how many people I've interviewed who said, yeah, I thought I'd be loving golfing and that sort of thing. You know, you see all these ads retiring, golfing and that sort of thing. But, you know, I got on the golf course and I wasn't any good at it. So it wasn't any fun. And I've always been good at what I do. So why would I suddenly now want to go and make a fool of myself? And, you know, there's a lot embedded in that. But I've heard it many different ways. And the point is to say, practice. Start taking lessons or practicing or just doing those things that you think are going to be great ways of filling your time. And I guess the last point is to say, you know, staying active is really important. That is one that, you know, yeah, I could go on and on about, but in the interest of time, I'll say, you know, I don't actually just mean physically active. I don't just mean like find ways to move however you can, although that's a very, very important point, because if we don't find ways to move, if we are always just looking for ways of getting around that, like hiring other people to move for us, moving the gardening or the household chores or whatever it is, you know, we get really accustomed to that in adulthood, sort of outsourcing certain tasks in our domestic sphere. And the more I've traveled and seen the way that that other cultures live, I see that that isn't essential, there's something really great about going up and down stairs in your life because you don't have any other choice because that's how houses are built, or, you know, doing your own, you know, cleaning of your house, that sort of thing. But again, I don't just mean physically staying active. I mean staying active in terms of finding ways to continually engage in whatever way is meaningful to you.
Really appreciate all of this. Quick story. I love your declutter your life. We're currently going through Marie Kondo in my home, which started off by my wife asking me, have you heard of this Marie Kondo? I said, yes, I bought the book as soon as it came out and I read it. Where is it? So I can't really find it. So I said, well, maybe you need that. So she's all over it. And I've got a catch-up list of my part in this. But you can see the value of in terms of the clarity. And it goes well with the freedom and the space you have in that phase of life. But those are great, great recommendations. And I know people really benefit from them. So thank you. Michelle, in closing, how can people best follow your work and research going forward?
Oh, sure. Well, I have a website. It's just michellepannersilver.com. I'm at the University of Toronto. It can be found through there. As you mentioned, I'm in a couple different departments here and they've got my links there. I think I'm also doing a number of different speaking engagements, and I think I'll try to post those. Most are like alumni associations and that sort of thing. But the ones that are publicly available, people are more than welcome. And I'm on LinkedIn. And I think those are probably the best ways. I really look forward to following your guys' work on the retirement conversation. I think you guys focus on really important ideas and make fantastic book suggestions. Not mine, but just broadly speaking, and that are so helpful for a range of different ages and different life transitions. Mm-hmm. So I'll be looking for what you guys come up with too.
Well, I appreciate it. I have a review of yours in draft, so people should stay tuned. I want to wait till we spoke with you because I've got some additional insights, but that's certainly been one of the best books we've come across. As a late in life gerontology student, I really appreciate the research-based works in particular, and yours really stood out in terms of what you put into it.
I appreciate your time today. Really much appreciate all the great points and everything. This would be very useful to our listeners. And thanks for your time. I hope you have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
Great conversation with Michelle, as expected, reading her book, phenomenal research and great insights there. Dennis, what are your takeaways?
First thing that she opened it with, talked about her personal story, about how she dealt with her father's, the end of her father's career, and that she was closing up his business, et cetera, and really gave her some really reflection, and her recognition that there's not a lot of focus on this transition. And for many people, this is, can be very complicated and ambiguous, especially for those that are dealing with a changing their identity and not sure how to handle that. She did say that there are a lot of people that are comfortable with this. So once again, retirement and this transition is different for everyone, clearly. But the people that struggle most with it, what do they have in common? I believe she mentioned that part of their life was very devoted to particular activities and a cause in some respect. They had a purpose, and that is now being restructured. And that can really cause somebody to create tensions in this transition. And she also mentioned that in reconciling some of those transitions, it's really recalibrating your identity, trying new things, motivating yourself, developing an energy, and in some cases, finding your true self. She gave the example of this doctor that she had spoken to who was a lifelong learner and decided to use that aspect of finding herself. She can continue to do that learning in other aspects of her life, which meant people volunteer. And there's so many different activities that people can really participate in. And finally, the last thing was she made 4 points when it came to what should people keep in mind to be top of mind when they're well prepared for this transition. And she mentioned financial planning, number one, which totally agree with. Number two, she mentioned decluttering, but it was more of not a physical decluttering, but a mental decluttering. Finding space, focusing on what was most important to you, can really give you a point north. What do you find joy in? Very important. Practice, start preparing. Do little things every day. Take a lunch break. That was great. But start somewhere and start doing something different in relation to what it is that you're moving towards. It was very, very good help. Good advice. And finally, staying active physically. Wow. I mean, that's so important. People need to keep active because it also feeds not only the body, but it also feeds the mind. It gives you that energy. So great advice. And Joe, what about yourself?
I was first struck by her research design, meaning that there's gold in looking at these different subsets. But then she also took it up to a higher level at the society level and talked a lot about ageism and how thinking of retirement and building systems and structures around retirement based on chronological age really limits the ability of organizations and society as a whole to really maximize and optimize the contributions that older workers and older people can make, and that's highly individualized and can really be a matter of choice. So I think there's a lot going on there to try to change that, which is encouraging, but it's certainly a major, major issue. Second one that struck me was her story about the Olympian, and really characterized it as the need to close a chapter. And that rang a bell for me because one of my favorite books I've read in recent years, in addition to this one, is by Richard Rohr, Falling Upward. And he talked about in Japan, career military people were struggling, leaving the military, not having a sense of purpose. They were kind of seen as loyal soldiers. And they determined they were missing a ritual to close that chapter. And I thought that was an interesting thing for people to think about as individuals. How do you close that chapter if you do hang it up, so to speak, and shift gears and transition? But close that chapter from that phase of life can be an important and liberating thing. And then what also jumped out to me was her whole set of comments and recommendations about finding what really motivated you in your career or motivates you today, what made you really good at what you do, and look at ways to rechannel that to help others. She talked about in terms of recalibrating for your new world, but how can it help your family? How can it help you personally? How can it help your broader community? And I think that opens up a wide range of possibilities that can be really energizing to people and lead to a satisfying retirement. And then I have to comment on decluttering as well, echoing what you said, but since we're going through that right now, I hesitate to ask my wife the question, do I still spark joy? What pile are you going to put me in? We'll see how that's an open question right now. But I'm sure she said she'd put me in the middle, but I'm trending upward. But I think that connected to me in thinking about retirement, giving people freedom. And what this decluttering yourself, decluttering your life, she talked about, both physical and mental, can really give you clarity to really make the most of that freedom.
Thanks for joining us today on The Retirement Conversation. You can listen to all episodes of our podcast by subscribing to them on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play, or on our website at retirementwisdom.com.